This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
From technology and test scores to Common Core, curriculums and teaching techniques are changing all over the country. And a lot of different sources are weighing in on what those changes should look like. But are the students getting enough input in the process, and should they?
Our past is not our kids' future. So counting on what it was like when we were in school doesn't make any sense to anybody.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the question of student voice in the education system. We'll also meet a young man from the UK who says he's addicted to selfies. And we'll spend an academic minute with Onomatopoeia. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. How much voice do students have in their own education, and how much should they have? Those are questions whose answers have been changing over the years. New data from the 47th annual PDK Gallup poll of the public's attitudes towards public schools indicate Americans are beginning to see the importance of student voice in school. The majority of respondents say they believe student engagement at school and whether a student feels hopeful about their future are important factors in evaluating a school, even more so than standardized testing. Russ Qualia is the executive director of the Qualia Institute for School Voice and Aspirations. We spoke recently, and I asked him what we're talking about when we say student voice.
Well, we're talking about putting in the forefront something we take for granted. And what we take for granted is that we make this assumption that all students have a voice that's being listened to. I'm the first one to say students do have a voice, but it's not the voice necessarily being practiced the way I think it should be. So when I talk about student voice, it's about allowing students to speak openly in an environment that's driven by trust and responsibility. I believe right now our educational system is kind of the foundation for it, I believe, is driven by testing and accountability. And I think we need to make a shift. And that shift goes from testing and accountability to one of trust and responsibility, where the students are responsible for not only what they say, but how they say it, and then coming up with action items of what to do next. Typically, when people talk about student voice, and this is interesting, Bob, I think I spend more time telling people what student voice isn't than what it is, because they all think it's, oh, man, are we giving up the ship here to the kids? And I'm like, no, it's not about giving up anything. It's about taking advantage of a most valuable resource. To me, that's the students, and that students have something to teach us. But it needs to happen in a way where people are willing to listen. And it's not a survey. Because, well, you know, I've done the student voice survey. I'm like, yeah, that's great. Whatever. What are you doing with that information? How are you learning from it? How then are you leading forward with that kind of information?
So you're not talking about letting the inmates run the asylum then?
No, I just want the inmates to be a part of the asylum, actually. So much is being done to kids. And it's not in an evil way we do things to students in school, but I just see them as the potential, not the problem. And I see so much of the work in education now is trying to fix kids like they're broken. I don't see that. And this isn't something I woke up and said, wow, yeah, this is the enlightenment. It's taken me, you know, 20 years to get to a point where I honestly believe students have something to teach us. They know what it's like being a student more than we do. And one of the things I share with any educator is I tell them, our past is not our kids' future. So counting on what it was like when we were in school doesn't make any sense to anybody other than us, but it certainly doesn't make sense to the students, particularly when we're asking their opinions about things.
And of course, before I ask this, I'll say, of course, no two schools or school districts are exactly the same, so it's hard to generalize, but I'm going to ask you to anyway. How much input do students have in their education right now?
I don't think a lot. I mean, I agree with you. To me, every school is, they have their own separate DNA. Some schools really promote the importance of student voice. In other schools, it's a foreign concept, quite frankly. Or they do this thing around, to me, smoke and mirrors, where, oh yeah, we have student voice. We meet with the students once a month, or they have a student council. Oh, we give this annual survey. And again, to me, that's not having a voice. That's an opinion. I want student voice to kind of resonate where it's, I'm going to be able to share my opinion in an open environment, but I'm also going to take responsibility for what I say. So do I see that happening very often? No. To me, school voice, student voice is just not a natural way of being. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think our educational system is set up that doesn't even allow it to happen very often. But I also think this, and I hear this a lot lately, Bob, when I'm in the field, is that students aren't ready to have a voice. And this doesn't mean they don't want to have a voice. I don't think they know how to express themselves well yet, because for so long, we've kind of beat it out of them.
Should student voice have something to do with the content of the education or the mechanism of the education?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think a little of both, quite frankly. Because we, as educators, we have a level of expertise. We have experiences that these students don't have. We need to bring that to the table. But no one knows how students learn better than themselves or what interests them. Now, that doesn't mean we transfer everything to the level of interest, because there are some basics that they need to grapple that they may not even understand they need to understand yet. I mean, students don't know what they don't know yet. So it's not a matter of just letting them just nilly-willy take over kinds of things, but it's getting them actively involved in the process, the education process. And the reason for that is it creates a sense of ownership. The end game here, Bob, for me is this. When students have a voice, when they perceive they have a voice in decision-making in the school, when they believe that they're valued in the school, they are 7 times more likely to be motivated to learn. And I see this in my career. My career has gone from, well, here's a guy with long hair and Birkenstocks yapping about student voice, well, of course, because that's what he looks like he should be doing, to like, wow, he's got some real data that says this isn't just a feel-good kind of thing where kids are in the hall singing Kumbaya. But when these students believe they have a voice, when they're engaged in their learning, they're 7 times more likely to be motivated to learn. And that's the end game. I mean, that's what this is about.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the data you've collected. You've got the 7 times more likely to be motivated. What other kinds of data have you come up with over the years?
Well, one of the interesting things, the broad scope of the data is we look around 3 categories around self-worth, engagement, and having a sense of purpose. When we surveyed students, and now 20-plus years, over 1 million data points, actually, what we've learned is really 3 things from the kids in the big picture. The first one is they want us to know, us educators to know, that I matter as an individual, okay? The second thing they want us to know is that we matter collectively as students. And the third thing students want us to know is that you matter to us. In other words, the educators matter to students. And so here's some examples of some powerful data regarding the I matter piece. 46% of the students in this country think they're a valued member of their school community. Half the students in our country don't think they're valued. What's even more disheartening to me is this. 52% of the students in this country say their teacher cares if they're absent from school. Now think about that. 48% of the kids in this country do not think their teachers care if they show up. So when I talk to people about testing and all these other kinds of things, I said, you know, before you get your pants in a bunch about meeting AYP, maybe the first thing we should do is start worrying about whether these kids think we care if they even show up to school. So the data points that we go after isn't like this most convoluted, reconstructed way of getting at issues. We're just pretty straightforward with what we ask kids. We ask students, do teachers enjoy working with you? 64%. We ask kids, do you have a voice in decision-making at school? 47%. We're doing pretty well in half the kids in our schools, but we're not doing so well in the other half. In the half that we're doing pretty well in, they do think they have a voice because they do feel valued, because they do believe teachers care about them. But here's the piece that I share with teachers, is that they need to understand that they are the kids' heroes. And sometimes I hear, well, you know what, I'm not ready to be a kid's hero. And I tell staff all the time, I said, you know what, that's not your choice. Your choice is if you're a good one or a bad one. The students will decide if you're the hero or not. So your only choice in that is if you're a good one or a bad one. Choose to be a good one. And kids want that role model. They want a mentor. And I remind teachers all the time, I go, we're it. We're it. We need to start acting like it. And the best way to act like it is let these kids know that they matter to us.
I read something that you wrote. It's a great quote. Frustration is enthusiasm that's in need of an attitude adjustment. We're talking about teachers, students, or just life in general?
I'm thinking life in general, Bob. Let me tell you a funny story about that. It's something I said eons ago. I'm at a Chinese restaurant once, and I opened a fortune cookie, and it's like that statement is in there. And I said to myself, wow, I have really made it. I am now in a fortune cookie. So all these educators out there, they might think they're cool being published in these big-time journals. Well, how many educators do you know are in a fortune cookie?
That goes first line on the resume.
I think it should. I think it should. Let me talk about that just for a second. It is a life thing, and I started talking about that to teachers, quite frankly, and this is why. When I talk around student voice and teacher voice and principal voice, school voice in general, like how do we take that to the next level? How do we learn from that? People would always agree with it. They'd be excited by it, quite frankly. A month later, they're incredibly frustrated. They're really upset, and I'm saying, man, I go, I don't understand how you can be so for something and then be so upset by something. And their frustration was nothing was happening quick enough. And I realized, I said, you know what? I can live with this frustration. I am glad you're frustrated, because what I remind people of, we only get frustrated by things that we want better. So if I buy a car and it's really expensive and it's not running really well, holy cow, I get really frustrated. I'll get angry, quite frankly. But if I go to a party that I don't even want to go to in the first place and I seem incredibly bored and like, oh, man, just get me out of here, I'm not frustrated because my level of expectation was so low to begin with, it didn't really matter to me. So when I work with teachers and they say, wow, this is so frustrating to me, you know what I tell them? I go, great, because that's all that tells me is that that frustration is just a little bit of enthusiasm that needs an attitude adjustment. And that attitude adjustment is, let's not give up. Let's keep moving forward around this whole notion of student voice. So that's how that whole statement came about.
Well, let's look ahead. Is this seen as something that is necessary? I mean, is it widespread that people are saying now, okay, we really need to listen to student voice and give students a voice? And if so, what do we do with it?
Yeah, I do think it's becoming more widespread. It's not where it needs to be yet. I find this really fascinating as some self-reflection, quite frankly. I get introduced to do these various talks all over the world, and I feel incredibly fortunate to do that. But I always chuckle inside, Bob, when I'm introduced as this educational visionary. 30 years ago, I might have been, when I was talking about student voice and teacher voice then. I'm not a visionary anymore. I'm the most determined educator on the planet, and I just haven't given up on it. And because of that determination, and because we were able to put data with these concepts around the importance of voice and so on, it's because we did this data probably over the last 5-6 years, it really has caught on. And I don't think it's caught on because people automatically saw the light. I think it's caught on because we've shown some hot evidence that when student voice is in play, they do better academically. The other piece of data that is quite profound, actually, is one of the statements we asked, do your teachers know your hopes and dreams? Around this whole sense of purpose. And when we're talking about students' hopes and dreams, it's not students telling us what they want to be, but it's the kind of person they want to become. Like, who do you want to be? Not to name someone, but what kind of person? Do I want to be an innovator? Do I want to be a creator, a health service, whatever? I don't care what kids want to be. I want to know the kind of person they want to become. Only 34% of the kids say that their teachers know their hopes and dreams. Here's what's fascinating. Of those 34%, when we do know their hopes and dreams, they're 18 times more likely to be motivated to learn. There's nothing else out there on the planet that can make those kind of claims. As soon as you know your students' hopes and dreams, it lets them know first that you care about them as a person enough to even care about their future. The second thing it does, it allows you to make connections in your class around their hopes and dreams. That's not to dictate everything you're teaching has to be in that direction, but at least you can comment on it. At least you can draw some distinctions there between what they're learning and why they're learning it and how potentially it's going to impact their future. So I think it's data like that that is really starting to catch on and starting to make a difference. Again, the student voice piece for me isn't about a program. It's about a way of being. And until we can shift that culture in schools, as I said early on, moving away from testing and accountability to one of trust and responsibility, we're going to be having this conversation for the next 50 years without a whole lot of change happening.
Russ Qualia is the executive director of the Qualia Institute for School Voice and Aspirations. Still to come, technology has a big part in a student's education. It can also be a big problem in a student's life. That's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Danny Bowman is a 19-year-old from the UK and is one of the world's first confessed selfie addicts after posting 200 pictures of himself every day on Facebook and other social media platforms. During his addiction, he lost his friends, his education, his health, and almost his life. Now, after overcoming his addiction, Danny has turned his attention to raising awareness of how technology can affect mental health and started a campaign with the charity Fixers UK. From DW Radio, Ashley Byrne reports.
Internet and technology addiction isn't something young people necessarily enjoy talking about that much. But for Danny Bowman, it's talking about his problem which has helped him and which is now helping him to help others. Danny's ordeal began when he was still at school.
I was 14 years old when it all started. At that age, when I was trying to impress girls, and I simply wasn't getting that attention.
Danny would spend hours analysing his physical appearance in the bathroom mirror at home, but eventually he turned to new technology for more acute detail.
It was just at the time when iPhones were coming out and people were starting to take photos of themselves, even before they were called selfies. I just started taking them.
At first, Danny would take around 60 selfies a day, but it soon spiralled.
I was leaving class to do it 3 times a lesson. It got to the point when I was taking 200 selfies a day and I had to drop out of education for a short while, spending 6 months housebound, taking these photos constantly to try and see my imperfections.
Danny sought recognition and adoration for up to 10 hours every day and would post his pictures on social media.
I was putting the photos on Facebook and Twitter, and what people were saying to me was simply that I was ugly, pointing out flaws, being extremely, incredibly mean.
Despite the negative feedback, he couldn't stop himself posting selfies online. He lost weight and even tried to kill himself with an overdose. His mother managed to save him, and he was forced to get help and to receive therapy for technology addiction, OCD, and body dysmorphic disorder, and excessive anxiety about personal appearance.
Push technology away. I was so enclosed in myself and so worried about what I was thinking. And I think a lot of people feel like this these days. They're so indulged in their own lives. Sometimes you just need to push out and think how you can make a difference to others.
And thinking about others, for Danny, meant turning his attention to raising awareness of how technology can affect mental health.
I started my campaign with Fixers UK, which are a charity which gives young people a voice to help people with mental illness and with selfie addiction.
Fixers UK is a charity which lends practical support to young people who want to make a difference by setting up their own campaigns or groups.
I started on a small basis, local news, and then it took off and it went to an international crowd.
Danny made his own film about his experience.
One night I locked my room and just screamed. I felt so lonely.
And the interest in his story spread and he travelled the UK and the world talking about what he'd been through.
What I tried to do is then take it back to helping people who are suffering from mental illness.
Danny now meets people individually and in groups to share his experience and to help others through their own problems. Some contact him, others he meets on his campaign travels.
Seeing them, giving them positive words, helping them realise that they can get through it and go on to live fulfilling lives. It's amazing how many people I've met who do have the same problem that I did, you know, body dysmorphic disorder or selfie addiction. I know it sounds funny to say selfie addiction, but people do have this problem. It needs to be recognised and it needs to be given the correct attention which it deserves.
The medical world is undecided about the exact impact of new technology, but a recent survey of young people in the UK did find that many are worried about how much time they're spending online. Dr. Mark Griffiths from Nottingham Trent University is a leading expert in the field of addiction, but even he says defining internet or online addiction is very difficult.
If I was going to class somebody as an internet addict, what I'd be saying is that this activity is the single most important thing in this person's life. They do it to the neglect of everything else in their life. It conflicts with their relationships, their work, their schoolwork, depending on what age they are. They use it as a way of modifying their mood, either to get a buzz, a high, aroused, excited, or they do it to the exact opposite, to tranquilize, to escape, to numb, to distress, to relax. You know, they build up what I call tolerance over time. They need more and more of this internet activity or the game. They get withdrawal symptoms if they can't engage in it. But in fact, very few people fulfill those components. Some people can do it for lots of hours a day, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's negative.
But for people who already have some form of mental health issue to deal with, the internet can be destabilizing.
Well, it's interesting because my parents are both mental health professionals, which is quite interesting because, you know, for me, it was, you know, they'll understand, they sit. But the fact is, you know, it's their own kid. It's hard. It's really difficult for them, you know, to hear this. And they found it very difficult to actually put an illness on it. They couldn't really put an illness on it. And I think, you know, many people don't understand, many mental health professionals don't understand the connection between technology and mental illness. And I think it's a very clear connection, I think.
Liam, who's in his 30s from Manchester, suffers from bipolar disorder and paranoia and often struggles to manage his relationship with the internet. He'd like to meet a like-minded individual like Danny to talk through his problems.
What Danny's doing is tremendous, really. Not everyone has the strength to go on from negative mental health experiences to help other people. He's obviously a very strong character, very articulate. These are emerging technologies, the internet, then smartphones. We don't really know where we're going as a society with all these technologies. People like Danny are at the forefront of exploring the impacts on our mental well-being. He's a bit of a pioneer, really.
As well as campaigning and talking to others, Danny is lobbying the UK government for more support and early intervention to help people with mental health and technology-related issues. His selfie obsession is behind him, but he says he is watching the current global selfie craze with interest.
I'm watching the selfie craze with caution. Where I draw the line is when you're taking more than 20 or 30 selfies a day. You really need to check yourself before you wreck yourself.
This is Ashley Byrne for DW in the northeast of England.
You know, I've been doing this a lot of years, and there are still some words I think I've never said on the radio. Well, that list gets a bit shorter right now. Onomatopoeia, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Bang, moo, meow. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Lynn Perry, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Miami, explores whether the relationship of the sound of words and their meanings goes further than we think.
Why do we call a dog and not a cat? Are words iconic? That is, do they sound like what they mean? Or are they arbitrary? Linguists are trained to believe that the vast majority of words are, in fact, arbitrary. The outside of special cases of onomatopoeia, words like bang and moo, there's no relationship between what a word sounds like and what it means. This principle of the arbitrariness of the sign has been fundamental to modern linguistics and psychology, but our recent research topples this long-held axiom, showing that the words of spoken languages are in fact iconic in some very interesting ways. In a series of five experiments, we asked native speakers of English and of Spanish to judge the iconicity of about 600 words from their respective language. Overall, participants rated the words as somewhat iconic on average, an interesting finding, but it was the systematic patterns of their ratings that we found to be the most compelling. For example, in both languages, words from grammatical categories like adjectives, these are descriptive words like sticky, were judged to be higher in iconicity than nouns, so words for people, places, and things like sandwich. Most interesting of all, in both languages, we found that the words judged as highest in iconicity were learned the earliest by young children. This pattern suggests that the iconicity in English and Spanish words plays an important function in helping young children to learn language. Our study is the first to show that iconicity is prevalent across the vocabulary of a spoken language, suggesting that iconicity may play an important role in word learning. It's the nail in the coffin for the theory that languages are essentially arbitrary. Languages are not just arbitrary, but they're also iconic in some fundamental and consequential ways.
That was Lynn Perry of the University of Miami. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.